Before we move on to talking a little bit about attachment, there are two more things I want to cover with regard to anger. And the first is, why do in fact we get angry with people who behave badly? And why do we find it so difficult to have forgiveness and compassion for them? And I think there's a very simple answer to this. If we see someone behaving badly, then the correct perspective is simply to acknowledge there is a person doing a bad or harmful behaviour. So that is the correct perspective, to see that. But often when we see someone behaving badly, we don't adopt this perspective. Rather, often our perspective is, there's a bad person. There's a harmful, evil person, nasty person. What we've done here, of course, is we have fused the person and the behaviour together and made them one thing. In psychology, this is called cognitive fusion. And this is often how we, our perspective that we take. If we do cognitive fusion, we're in trouble. Because in any given situation, we've got two choices: accept or reject. And generally, if someone's behaving badly, we reject. But if we reject and do cognitive fusion, that translates into attacking the person. Getting angry at the person, maybe verbally or physically attacking the person. And if we sort of understand attacking the person is not very helpful, then we're only left with the other option, which is accept. But if we've done cognitive fusion, accept translates into accepting their bad behaviour. And of course, both attacking the person or accepting their bad behaviour is not a very beneficial thing to do. Also, of course, if we do this cognitive fusion, then when it comes to forgiveness and compassion, almost impossible. Because to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying, oh, what you did is okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind. So that's why it really becomes almost impossible to have forgiveness or compassion if we do this cognitive fusion. Because it feels like we're sort of accepting, we're okay with their bad behaviour. We're not okay. And also, if we do cognitive fusion, we end up with a fixed, biased view of that person. They're a bad person. Which means it becomes very difficult for us to acknowledge any of their good qualities. Because everyone has both good qualities and faults. Everybody. But if we've done cognitive fusion and see them as a bad person, bad people don't do good things. So if they happen to do something good, we often brush it off and say, oh, they didn't really mean it because they're a bad person. So we can't acknowledge their good qualities. So we end up with a fixed, biased view of that person. So, of course, the simple solution to all of this is don't do cognitive fusion. Because cognitive fusion is an invalid perspective. There are two things here. There is a person and there is a behaviour. There's not one thing. So if we simply adopt the correct perspective and acknowledge there is a person who's doing a harmful, bad behaviour, then we can have forgiveness and compassion for the person. And at the same time, not accept or tolerate their bad behaviour and be very forceful about their bad behaviour and address their bad behaviour. And try and help that person to overcome that bad behaviour. And also, therefore, if we have the correct perspective, then we can have forgiveness and compassion for the person, and at the same time not accept their bad behaviour at all, and be very forceful about that. And then we can end up with a balanced view of the person. This also applies not just for others, for ourselves. When we have done a bad behaviour, the correct perspective is simply again acknowledge, I have done this harmful behaviour. That's correct. But often we don't do that. We just go, I'm a bad person. And so if we do cognitive fusion for ourselves, again, we're in big trouble. Because we often end up attacking ourselves, beating ourselves up, and saying things like, I don't deserve forgiveness or compassion because I'm just a bad person. So we can't have forgiveness or compassion to ourselves, and we end up with a fixed, biased view of ourselves. And this is really why we suffer from so much low self-esteem in our modern society. Because in our modern society, not only do we simply seem to always focus on the negative, we're always focusing on the negative with cognitive fusion. I'm a bad person. I'm a hopeless person. I'm weak. I'm lazy. We're none of those things. We may have a habit of doing bad things. We may have a habit of being lazy, but we're not a bad person. We're maybe a person who does occasionally some bad, harmful behaviour. And if we can acknowledge that, we can have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves and not tolerate our negative behaviour, address our negative behaviour and work to overcome it. And this is also the difference between regret and guilt. If we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on? Bad me, bad me. Guilt is completely useless. All it does is it makes us feel bad, it paralyzes us. It doesn't even address our negative behavior. And unfortunately, it seems to have been used over the centuries as a way to have power over people. So we don't need to feel guilty about anything at all. It's completely useless. It doesn't help at all. It just makes us feel bad. Paralyzes us. Whereas if we've done something harmful and we regret, what are we focusing on? Bad behavior. So regret comes from a correct perspective. Acknowledging, I've done a harmful behavior, I regret that. Let's fix that. Let's overcome that. So we can have compassion and overcome that negative behavior. So whether it's with respect to ourselves or others, if we do cognitive fusion, we're in trouble. Questions?
What if it is repetitive, even if it's
then we still have compassion and address our bad behaviour. Of course, some of our habits are very strong. And so we have to acknowledge we won't be able to eliminate them overnight. And when we talk about regret, you know, we're talking about sincere regret, not sort of, you know, going to the temple or church, saying a few prayers, I'm sorry for doing all these things, and then going back and doing them again. That's not regret. Sincere regret is inbuilt, is the wish to overcome that. If there's no wish to overcome it, there's no regret. It's just sort of lip service. So if we have strong habits, of course, then it will take time to overcome it. But if we can really do this, we can overcome it over time. If we do this and we have strong habit, our self-esteem will plummet. I mean, we'll be rock bottom. I'm just a bad person. I'm just hopeless. No hope. And then we'll suffer. And we won't go anywhere because we're not addressing our bad behaviour. We're just racked with guilt and low self-esteem. And then we're stuck.
You're saying we think that this is very attractive. You define it as a mental something.
Mental factor in
when
our mind.
Like separation between me and my mental capacity, me and my mind. It's not the
same. We have to be very careful. I was hoping someone would bring this up. We're not talking about separating. We're talking about distinguishing. You can't have an action separate from the person. Impossible. But the action is not the person. We need to distinguish these two elements in every situation. So we're not talking about separating. Oh, it wasn't me. It was the action. I'm not to blame. That's separation. That's denial. That's the opposite here. That comes from cognitive fusion. I didn't do it. Wasn't me. What we're talking about here is distinguishing, not fusing. And of course, by doing this, we're accepting responsibility. Here, I didn't do it. I'm not responsible. So this is a very important point. So I was hoping someone would bring this up. We're not separating, we're distinguishing.
I want to know if I'm having, if it's very challenging.
The action?
To distinguish between my mind and me. I am not my mind.
Right.
It's very natural that it would be very hard for me to understand that the person in front of me didn't do. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but it's very, if it's hard for me to do it for myself, it's very hard to do it for you to say, oh, it's not him, it's the action. So that means...
No. It's not the action. It's that person is doing the action.
Okay.
You can't leave that out. You can't say, oh, they didn't do it, it was the action. That's separation. The only thing we can say, that person did the action. You can't say it wasn't them, it was the action. That's separation. So there are two extremes, is fusion and separation, denial. They're the two extremes. This is the correct middle way between those two extremes. Because that separation, when we do it for ourselves, I didn't do it, wasn't me, I'm okay. Well, they didn't do it, they're okay. Because that's the thing, that's this one. You know, another version of this is that we don't know how to deal with it, so we just cut it, we separate. So that's also a wrong perspective, of course.
But you do say you are not your mind.
Right, but I have a mind. We're not saying the person and the mind are two separate things. We're saying we have a mind. We do an action. There is relationship. They're always connected. There's no separation. But there's no identifying either. And this is a key point that's going to come up when we talk about the nature of reality. So I'm very happy that you brought that up, because it's a very important point. Down the back.
Maybe you'll come on to this, but how is it possible to talk of good and bad actions if everything is constantly changing and nothing has objective reality for its own sake?
Yeah, so this again, we'll talk on the nature of reality day. We're not talking about some sort of, what's the word in psychology used, where we just make up whatever we want. What's that called? Idealism?
Voluntary.
What's the word? I don't know. Is anyone here is idealism or something? I think it's called. That's not the Buddhist view. Right. And to find the two extremes within Buddhism, this sort of objective world and then I'm just making up reality as I like. The middle way is what we're trying to find between those two extremes. But we'll talk about that.
When we have the correct perspective and I see the person doing the bad action, and my reaction on this will then not be an afflictive emotion. So
no guarantee. There's no guarantee. Yeah. So there's no guarantee that even if you have that, you won't react, because we have strong habits. But what I'm suggesting is that if we think and speak like this, we have a better chance of not reacting. And a better chance of responding with compassion. No guarantee that we will.
So, but we can create new patterns?
Exactly. So the more that we think and speak in this way, the easier it becomes for us to do this. And the more we do it, the easier it becomes spontaneous. So this is really the starting point. If we keep thinking and speaking like this, we're stuck. If we think like this, I think there's no hope to develop compassion fully. It's just not going to work. Because this is opposite to that. It's just not going to work. Unfortunately, we've been programmed to speak and think like this since we were this high. You know, a little child does something bad at home, bad girl, bad boy. I mean, it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. But that's why we've been programmed. So we need to reprogram ourselves to think and speak in a correct way. Then we've got the basis to start to do this. But it's not just going to happen like that. It'd be good, but...
So is the goal there then, let's say that you're the one that has to reprimand the bad action, let's say you're the mother and you've got the child, does that mean that the bad action, I mean in the case of the mother and child, obviously you want to act with compassion, does that mean that the consequence of that has to come from the root of compassion, or will more likely...
So remember, in this address, it's on the basis of compassion, but how we address it, from the question before... We need to have as much wisdom as we can. Otherwise, the way in which we address it could be not very good. Even with a compassionate motivation, we could be deluding ourselves. We may have a real compassion for that person, but we think, okay, the way to really help them is to do such and such, which is actually quite harmful. So we need to make sure that these two things are always together. Otherwise, it's a mess.
And the wisdom comes from understanding the true nature of reality.
Not only, but many other types of wisdom as well. This is a very general wisdom. It's not just the nature of reality. But, of course, nature of reality is very helpful. But many other types of wisdom as well. More conventional level of wisdom. Yeah.
When I see someone doing something, I don't see that person is doing that action. I see all the universe makes the person do that action. So it's very different because I don't want to have idea of self. So if we deny the idea of self, there is no person who are doing something. And what about Buddhist point of view? Like compassion is like, why is that guy doing that? Because there must be reason from society, universe.
Yeah. Where, of course, and we're going to talk about this, of course, in naturality. Person is not equivalent to self. Self is a false view of person. There's no Buddhist tradition that says there's no person. No Buddhist tradition says that. Buddhism refutes self. Self is a false way of seeing ourselves. Buddhism refutes that. There is a person. How does that person exist? That's what we're going to look at. Now, we often have a false way of seeing a person. We believe they are self. This what's called self. But what that means, we're going to talk about. So that's what we need to be very clear about. When Buddhism says there's no self, we're not saying there's no person. There is a person that we can have compassion for. The question is, how does that person exist? That's coming in a couple of days' time.
Even if there is a person exists, what the person is doing is not exactly that one person is doing. Something makes the person is doing that.
Of course. The action, the doing, also has many causes and conditions. Of course. Everything has. Yes. Very good.
That was Buddhist idea.
Of course, of course. Of course. I mean, sometimes... In how to develop compassion for the person is, as you said, is what is driving that person to do the bad behaviour is the mental affliction. So if you want to get angry at something, get angry at the mental affliction, because that's what's driving the person. So sometimes you'll see this. I think this is what you're talking about. Yeah. Sure.
You said in the correct perspective, when you do something bad, we'll be there, and that's good, and that's not in the negative... What do we do?
Very good. You're talking about good actions now.
It's a bad action, but as well as good.
Yeah. Then we'd better move on after this point. This also is a problem, or can be a problem, if we do it with good behaviour. Unfortunately, in our modern society, sometimes to overcome low self-esteem, they use a technique which just goes to the other extreme. Instead of trying to overcome low self-esteem because the child or the person is thinking they're a bad person, they say, you're a good person. You're a special person. Disaster. Absolute disaster. Because what's going to happen is if we do the cognitive diffusion on the positive for a young child, you're a good person, you're a special person. Child says, oh, I'm special. I'm better than everyone else. And then, of course, when they can see they can't live up to that tag of special person, they plummet even deeper into low self-esteem. So what we need to do with good behaviour is this. So if a person is doing a good action, instead of doing cognitive diffusion and saying, you're a good person, you're a fantastic person, you praise the behaviour. You say to the person, that thing you did was fantastic. Then it will encourage the person to do the good behaviour again. If you do this and you praise the person, they maybe just get a big head thinking they're better than everyone else. Big ego trip. Not very useful. Similarly for ourselves, if we do a good thing and we do this, special person, I'm better than everyone. Not good, not helpful, just ego trip. If we do, we have to do this. I have done a good thing and praise our behaviour. And then we'll want to continue to do it. So whether it's on harmful or beneficial, if we do this, very good. Okay, we need to move on. We need to move on. If it's quick.
Yeah.
If we understand it in this way, yes. Of course we can say good person, bad person, understanding what we mean, a person who's doing good behaviour and bad behaviour. But the problem is if we use those words, good person, bad person, we end up doing this and then we end up in these problems. So that's what I'm suggesting. Of course we can say good person, understanding we're talking about a person who's doing good things, okay, but if we use that language, it's so easy to slip into this, and then we have problems. So maybe better not to use that sort of language, rather there's a person who does a lot of good things. That's going to be very helpful for us to develop compassion and so forth, and good self-esteem for ourselves. Okay, we better move on. Right, attachment. So most people, of course, understand that attachment, very harmful, anger is very harmful, we want to overcome it. But when it comes to attachment, usually it's a different story. Because here in Buddhism, we're also talking about eliminating attachment 100%. It's a mental affliction. But then if people hear that, they go, oof, I don't think I want to get rid of my attachment. Because if I get rid of my attachment, my life is going to become very boring, very bland. I'm not going to enjoy anything anymore. Actually, it's the complete opposite. Our attachment interferes with our enjoyment of the simple pleasures in life. As we saw, I think, yesterday, if we have strong craving and attachment for things, that often leads to a lot of worry and anxiety about not getting them, not getting enough, losing them. And if we don't get it, often leads to a lot of frustration. Even if we do get it, it often leads to overindulging and more suffering. And when we lose it, we get upset. And then, of course, attachment is never satisfied, so we end up more craving, more craving, more craving. As I mentioned, I think, yesterday, attachment's always looking for something bigger, better, and different. We're never satisfied. So actually attachment interferes with our enjoyment of the simple pleasures in life. And this was really much highlighted to me many years ago when I did my first long meditation retreat. I was on the side of a mountain in Spain, beautiful view, nice little retreat hut. They were bringing food from the centre every day in a little basket. Food was very nutritious, but same menu basically, each week, same food. And so even if it's some food we like, but we're eating it week after week after week, it doesn't take too many weeks before we go, oh, not that again, because our attachment's going, I want something bigger, better and different. We're never satisfied. What I found was, after about a month in this retreat, I thought, wow, the cook's putting more effort into the cooking now. It's tasting better. And then after a few more weeks, it kept getting better and better, tasting better. After about 6 weeks, I thought, no, this is exactly the same food as I was eating 6 weeks ago. What's going on? And what I realised was that due to being in meditation retreat, mind calming down, my craving and attachment was calming down. So I was actually enjoying the food much, much more than I would, because the craving and attachment's never satisfied. And what I also found was, you know, I was in a hut with a beautiful panoramic view. Again, if we're in a place with a beautiful view, after a few weeks, we don't even really notice it anymore. But what I found was, again, week after week, things got more beautiful. The view got more beautiful. Little tiny things, a little tiny flower was, wow, that's amazing. Again, what happened was my craving and attachment was settling down. I was actually enjoying the beauty. So if we actually reduce our attachment, what you're going to find is you're going to enjoy the simple pleasures in life much, much more than you do now. So you're not going to lose out. But then people go, oh, okay, maybe I can understand that. Maybe that might be the case. But I definitely need attachment to have a relationship. Without that, no hope. Again, attachment in a relationship is harmful to the relationship. It interferes with the relationship. And part of the problem here is, again, terminology. The word attachment. Because in psychology, again, that word attachment, I think, is defined a little bit different, or quite different from how the Buddhists use that word. In fact, I've got a couple of definitions of attachment from psychology here. One definition of attachment in psychology is that attachment is an enduring emotional tie to a special person characterized by a tendency to seek and maintain closeness, especially during times of stress. Another definition, a feeling that binds one to a person, thing, cause or like. And another definition of attachment in psychology is a feeling of affection for a person. And some synonyms for the word attachment in psychology: affection, devotion, regard, loyalty, love. Whereas the word attachment in Buddhism is very different to that. As we saw, attachment in Buddhism is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So in a relationship, our attachment actually sees the other person as a thing, as an object to satisfy me. Whereas loving kindness or love, the Sanskrit word is maitri, the Pali word is metta. And they are better translated as loving kindness rather than love. Because the word love in our English language is an emotion, and it often implies some sort of intimate behaviour. Whereas maitri and metta is not an emotion. It's an aspiration, it's a wish. It's a wish for ourselves and others to be happy, a wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. So therefore, much better to translate as loving kindness rather than love. So loving kindness or love then in a relationship is simply for the other person, is a wish for them to be happy. And the fine print is without expecting anything in return. What we would call unconditional love, no strings attached love. Conditional love, strings attached love, is love polluted by attachment. And that sounds like this. I will love you as long as, here comes a condition, as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. I'll love you that long. So that's attachment speaking. So to distinguish between love and attachment is very simple. Attachment or love is saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. So attachment's all about me, 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 me. And it actually sees the person as not a person, as a thing to satisfy me. So in every relationship, there are these two dynamics going on. Usually they're mixed together. And so we feel if we get rid of attachment, we'll get rid of the loving kindness. But they're actually two different dynamics that we can distinguish and then reduce the attachment as much as possible and increase the loving kindness as much as possible. And then our relationships will improve. Now, of course, attachment is something pervasive in our life. So it's not like, okay, by next week I'm going to get rid of my attachment. It's not going to happen. In fact, in Buddhism, we're going to see this tomorrow, I think, this whole world we live in is called the desire realm. Why? Because our basic drive is desire, attachment. And I remember studying one text from the 4th century Indian Buddhist master who says there are two main cravings and attachment in the human realm. What do you think they might be? The two main cravings and attachment.
Eating and sexuality.
Exactly. Food and sex. So I don't think much has changed in the last 2,000 years. One more point. In Buddhism then, when we talk about this loving kindness, we're talking about developing it for ourselves and others. And often you'll hear things like, we are to love everyone equally. And then we have some very strange ideas what that means. We think that means, according to Buddhism, I need to spend the same amount of time with everyone and behave in the same way to everyone. Disaster if we try to do that. Absolute disaster. Particularly if it involves intimate behaviour. Disaster. When Buddhism says love everyone equally, what they're saying is to have the equal attitude of wishing everyone equally to be happy. That's equal. How we express that loving kindness will be completely dependent on our relationship with the person. With our partner, we would express that loving kindness in an intimate way and probably spend a lot of time with them. We would express that same loving kindness to our family members in a different way and spend less time with them. And we would express that same loving kindness to our neighbours and work colleagues in a very different way and maybe spend no time with them. So that's what it means to love everyone equally, having the equal attitude, not equal behaviour, not equal time. Okay. Any questions about this before we move on to the next topic? Oh, yes, sorry, you're first. No, in the front and then...
I'm just curious because I feel like there's a lot of compassion and sort of compassion is not what I meant to say. It's more like a lack of expectation because nothing is permanent and no one is stable, etc. And to be able to accept that, how does that work with building family, marriage, things like that, which do require expectations and commitments?
Yep. I'll give the short answer now because I'm going to talk about that in more detail later. Often we have this perspective, impermanence is bad news. Exactly, because everything's changing, everything finishes. And I'm going to quote from a book where they say impermanence is good news. Because if things didn't change, we couldn't improve. So again, we always have the perspective, the negative perspective. Oh, everything's finishing, coming to an end. Oh. Whereas actually, change means we can improve. So in that sense, change is good news, but I'm going to talk more about that coming. It's going to come. Down the back and then over there. Yeah.
You said we have to reduce our attachment, but we need to get to a point where there's no attachment at all in a relationship, or just a little bit?
Of course, the long-term goal is to eliminate attachment fully, but the reality, as I mentioned, attachment is pervasive in our life. And as much as possible to reduce the attachment, the more we can reduce it, the better our relationships will be. That's all. And it will be a lifelong work to do that. It's not like by next year, attachment gone, it's good. It's not going to happen probably. So we'll need to keep working on it. But the more we can reduce it, the better relationships will be. Because again, attachment is... I can't remember the person that talks about, you know, in a relationship, it's an I relationship. Person to person, that's the relationship we have is I to I. I as in me to them. Attachment, it's not an I relationship, it's an I-it relationship. Attachment doesn't see the other person as a person. Attachment sees the other person as a thing, as an object to satisfy me. I don't think we would be like to be seen as a thing, an object, to satisfy, would we? So it's very harmful in a relationship, that perspective.
But we choose like the people who like are a couple, like,
yeah. So
we choose the people that we hang around with in attachment, and
generally if we base on who we enter into a relationship purely on attachment, usually after a couple of weeks, we go, what did I see in that person? Because attachment, remember, is distorting, exaggerating. So what we'll find is that when we enter into a relationship that was based more on this and less on attachment, it usually is more durable and lasts longer. If we enter into attachment with none of this and all attachment, usually very quickly it disintegrates because there's no basis.
Non-attachment will never be into the relationship in the beginning.
Why not?
Because we're supposed to like want everyone to be happy. It's like, it's,
but again, this is not a behavior, it's an attitude.
Okay.
So with this attitude, we can behave in a very intimate way with a person.
Similar to that, I'm not sure exactly where how to differentiate between the attachment. Because sometimes attachment is tendency or feeling of belonging. I mean, with a spouse or with family, and you know, if you want to feel the feeling of belonging or you know, wanting to spend time together
Fine. I mean, yeah, wanting to spend time with families and friends is good. I mean, what we find is that often the measure of how much attachment is in that is how upset do we get if we can't be with them? The more upset we are, the more attachment. Of course it's good to be in, you know, if we can manage to be together with our family and friends, good. We can enjoy and benefit. If they're not there, okay, we'll do something else. But if they're not there and we get really frustrated, upset, it's attachment. Because we're wanting to be with them so that we get something. So that we're just seeing them as a thing to satisfy me. I can't be satisfied now, so I'm frustrated and upset. So that's usually the measure of how much attachment is in something, not just relationships, but enjoying physical experiences, you know, good food or whatever. If we get frustrated or upset when we don't get it, then there's a sure sign there's a lot of attachment there. So that's hard to see a little bit. Last question, then we move on.
I'm just curious because there's a lot of psychological studies that have been done that a person grows and is, you know, better in their own skin when they're surrounded with people they love. And
exactly.
But then, if you want to detach from that, I mean, you should be happy on your own. You said that you should not be angry if you're not with the person you love. But there's psychological study that proves that people that are surrounded are happier than people that are alone.
Exactly. When we say don't have attachment. We're not talking about detachment. That's the other extreme. That's a bit like separation is the other extreme. So Buddhism, we never use the word detachment. We need to practice detachment because that's separation. That's pathological. So both of these are extremes. Attachment and detachment are the two extremes we're trying to avoid. We're trying to find the middle way, and that's based on the interconnected nature of reality. And the more that we express loving kindness, the more we will feel connected. You know, often people feel like they've got a big hole here they need to satisfy. What creates that hole is attachment. There's no hole there. Attachment creates it. I've got to be near people because I need to fill this hole, this lack. Because attachment's never satisfied. If we get rid of attachment and we express the loving kindness, there's no hole there at all. Okay, let's move on. What I'd like to do now is have a look at how mental afflictions lead to actions, lead to suffering or dukkha, this process of the first two noble truths. Because we said that the cause or origin of dukkha or suffering is mental afflictions and action. So I want to look at how that process works now. In particular, we looked at that the underlying root of everything is this fundamental ignorance, this mistaken view of reality. How does that lead to mental afflictions and so on? So for that, we're going to use this suffering and its causes chart that you have. So this is a process that describes these first two noble truths. How from the distorted view of reality that leads to mental afflictions, that leads to our behaviour, that leads to our state that we find ourselves in now. So let's have a look at that in a little bit more detail here. So the first step of the process, we can talk about seed of ignorance. So remember here, this word ignorance is our misunderstanding of the nature of reality. It's our grasping onto an independent me here, and there's an independent objective world out there. And seed means habit. So we have this habit of believing that there's a me here and an independent objective world there. According to Buddhism, we've had that habit since we were born and well before that. And when we look out on the world, everything, in fact, appears to exist independent of us. So there appears to be what's called subject-object duality. There's a duality. There's a subject here, an independent subject here, independent object there. Subject-object duality. So that's how things appear to exist. But here, what we're saying is that things are not existing as they appear to us. Even though there appears to be an independent me here and an independent world there, that's not how me and the world exist. So this is called mistaken dualistic appearance. That this dualistic appearance of me, independent world, is mistaken. It's deceiving us. Everything always appears to us in this way. We've never had any other appearance. And because we have the habit of believing that, we never question appearances. We just accept. means we go to step two, ignorance. We just automatically accept, yes, me here, world there. So that's ignorance. Ignorance is just simply grasping onto independent me here, independent objective world there. Now, in every one of our experiences, we have this mental factor of feeling that I briefly talked about yesterday. Meaning we experience things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So let's say, for example, we're looking over here at these flowers. These flowers appear to exist completely independent of us. We have the habit of believing that, so we never question that. We just automatically accept, yes, there's some flowers there existing completely independent of me. And let's say when we look at these flowers, we're having a pleasant experience. That pleasant experience, together with the belief that those flowers exist independently of me, will lead us to the third step, a misconception. Because if I'm having a pleasant experience and I believe that those flowers existing independent of me, of course I'm naturally going to assume there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant experience. So I'm going to see those flowers as inherently attractive. They're attractive from their own side. Or, if I look at those flowers and have an unpleasant experience, together with the belief that those flowers are independent of me, I'm naturally going to assume there must be some unattractive quality there that's causing my unpleasant experience. We'll see them as inherently unattractive. Or if I'm having a neutral experience, and neutral just means neither pleasant nor unpleasant, so very often our experiences, many of our experiences are neither really pleasant nor unpleasant, they're very just neutral. So if I'm having a neutral experience when I see them, I'm going to, of course, naturally assume there must be some neutral qualities there causing my neutral experience. We'll see them as inherently neutral. When we get to the third step, the fourth step easily follows. Again, let's say I'm looking at these flowers. They're appearing, I'm having a pleasant experience, and then I'm believing there must be some attractive quality there causing it. I'm seeing them as inherently attractive. I like pleasant experiences, I want pleasant experiences, those flowers seem to be causing my pleasant experience, I want those flowers. Attachment. Or, if I'm having an unpleasant experience, when I'm looking at those flowers, I don't like unpleasant experiences, I don't want unpleasant experiences, those flowers seem to be causing my unpleasant experience, get them out of here. Aversion. Or, if I'm having a neutral experience, that's simply going to reinforce my belief that those flowers exist independent of me, which of course is ignorance, but often here they use the other word for ignorance, confusion. And again, confusion doesn't mean here, are these flowers or not? It's confusion about how they exist. It's believing they exist independent. So again, it's just another word for ignorance. So these are the three poisons, three core mental afflictions, which lead to the other mental afflictions, This is what's driving our behaviour. And every action we do, motivated by mental affliction, from a Buddhist perspective, has a result, a consequence. And the result is our experiences. And our experiences collectively, the Buddha used the word dukkha to describe them. So, of course, we haven't looked at this process here yet, but we're going to look at that this afternoon. That's the topic for this afternoon. So this is how our mistaken view of reality, this idea, this belief, this grasping on independent me, independent world, leads to us being stuck in this state of dukkha. Questions?
Number four, I didn't understand the third point, confusion. Before you were always talking about attractive, non-attractive, neutral.
Neutral. So it's neutral.
How turn neutral into confusion? Because in confusion is a kind of link to ignorance, right?
Confusion is ignorance.
But before
this is also ignorance.
Before it was neutral. How? Because always
inherently neutral.
Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Always those three
feelings. Correct.
And then
here,
aversion, confusion.
Right.
Wouldn't it be like test with aversion and neutralness or something?
No, because what we're talking about is not from there, but from here. We're talking about seeing the flowers as inherently neutral. Neutral from their own side, which already is ignorance. Grasping onto them being inherently neutral. So that's what we're talking about here. We're just grasping onto them inherently neutral.
Yeah, sure, but the feeling is still neutral, right?
Yeah, sure.
So confusion, sure. Neutral confusion.
No, you don't have to say that.
Where is the word neutral, or the feeling of neutral?
Yeah, but here we're not talking about feeling anymore. We're talking about the mental affliction now. We're talking about these feelings leading to these mental afflictions.
Yeah, when you say action, you mean karma?
Yeah, so the essential word for that is karma.
Can you explain more about what you mean action like?
That's the topic for this afternoon.
Okay.
We're spending the whole afternoon on this. Yeah.
Is it seed of ignorance and mistaken dualistic appearance, or is it the seed of ignorance is the mistaken dualistic appearance?
No. This is separate. This is mental affliction. This is an appearance. It's an appearance that we receive.
Because it's ignorance to have these feelings of pleasant, unpleasant.
No.
Feelings.
No.
So how
if we have pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings together with ignorance, we end up doing this. They have to be together.
Okay. So you have to have the ignorance.
Yeah, both of those together lead to this. Like, both of these together lead to this. These together lead to this.
Okay. I don't understand the differentiation here, the seed and the mistake. Like,
well, the mistaken dualistic appearance is an appearance that we are receiving. So maybe I can add a little bit more to the chart to understand this. So every time we have ignorance, every time we're grasping onto independent me, independent world, of course we're reinforcing the habit, which is the seed. So it's reinforcing. But also ignorance has another side effect. And that's often called latency of ignorance, or sometimes called stain of ignorance. That ignorance stains our mind. And to sort of understand what we mean by this, often analogy is given in the text. They say, imagine you have a bowl, you have a clove of garlic, you put the garlic in the bowl. Even if you take the garlic out, the garlic has stained the bowl with the smell. Likewise, ignorance stains our mind with this latency. What does this stain do? Is that because we have these stains in our mind, whenever we come into contact with an object, that object appears to exist independent of us. That's why we have this mistaken dualistic appearance, is because of these stains in our mind. So the analogy I give here is often like, these stains are like wearing green sunglasses. When we look out on the world through green sunglasses, everything appears green. Likewise, when we look out on the world through these stains, everything appears to exist independent of us. That's why we have this appearance.
When you say things appear to be independent of us, how are they dependent on us?
We're going to talk about that. That's a couple of days' time. The short answer is that things exist dependently in three ways, and we're going to look at that in a couple of days' time.
Can you go directly, like the mistaken dualistic appearance also leads directly to the attachment, the aversion, the confusion?
Directly. Well, I think you can only have attachment if you have a pleasant experience. I mean, I think just a mistaken dualistic appearance wouldn't directly lead to attachment. It would have to, you'd have to have this in here. Okay. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
When we talk about the latency, this is like, what comes first? The stains or the scene? Because it's like a matter of habit or education?
From a Buddhist perspective, we've had this beginningless. Because as with the conservation of mass energy, conservation of consciousness means ignorance can't pop into existence from nothing. It requires a previous moment of ignorance. So there was no first beginning. Just like there's no first beginning of the material universe.
So this is the kind of the way, like you said yesterday about the window, that this is like, there is no clean window, which is stained with dirt. There is something like you said,
I mean, these are like stains on the mind. These are like dirt on the mind. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Okay. So everyone, like every person, was born with some ignorance?
Absolutely.
So it's not something that...
So we were not born with tabula rasa. We weren't born with a clean slate. Because if we were, there's no way ignorance would just pop into existence without a cause. Impossible. So the fact that we have ignorance now proves we weren't born without it. Because if we were, we wouldn't have it now.
So it's not a matter of education or...
Of course, education, and that's the thing we're going to talk about. I have one more presentation to give before lunch. Education, or bad education, can affect this as well. We're going to look at that. That's coming up in the next presentation.
What happens to the person who has attained Buddha state? He will leave his ignorance.
Yes, gone.
So the person born next...
We'll talk about that. It's coming. That's tomorrow. The whole process we're looking at tomorrow.
Maybe you'll mention it now with the education, but I'm trying to understand it in like the practical matter. Let's say food taste. You mentioned garlic. So let's say I don't like garlic, and I never liked it. So that's a seed of ignorance, because
no.
I don't understand, because it's I do aversion. I don't enjoy it every time.
No. But you can not like garlic and have no aversion. You just don't like it, so you don't eat it. It's okay. No problem. But if you have aversion coming in...
That's exactly what I'm trying to understand. Where does the line cross? Where is, okay, I don't like it, or, okay, aversion, I don't want to see it?
I mean, there's many gradients of this, of course. And the very subtle levels of aversion, we can't notice now, because our mind is not very refined. But what you're going to find is, particularly if you do through the shamatha practice, and you calm the mind and focus the mind... That threshold that I talk about will go down. And what you're going to notice it'll become more and more obvious when this subtle aversion comes in your life. You'll notice that. Now we don't notice it at all.
I understand. No, what I'm trying to say is that basically, I understand 1 to 6.
Sure.
It makes me doubt all my taste and everything, because maybe the fact that I don't like garlic is just the seed of ignorance. It's not me not liking. You understand where I'm taking it? Maybe it's not.
No, I don't think so. But I mean, the thing is that we have so strong habit with regard pleasant and unpleasant of attachment and aversion, it would be difficult for us to have a dislike and not have aversion at some level now. It would be very difficult. So at our level, if you have a dislike for something, we can be pretty sure that mixed in with that will be some level of aversion, for sure, because we have a strong habit. The more we can reduce that aversion, the less that dislike will cause any, any mental affliction. We won't go, like this.
Yeah.
If we can just get, we just won't eat it. It's okay, no problem. Yeah.
So the seed of ignorance is beginningless. So the mind was
beginningless,
clear, and knowing underneath. But it can become clear and knowing.
If we can eliminate, the Buddhist assertion is we can eliminate these mental afflictions from the mind. That's the assertion. Yes.
But they were there from the beginning.
Yes. Okay. That's the assertion. Okay, one more point here, and then there's one more presentation I wanted to give before lunch, is these flowers. Let's say we're looking at them and we're having a pleasant experience. Where is the beauty? Is there beauty there?
No.
Is the beauty there?
No.
Because if the beauty's there, it would mean everyone who sees these flowers clearly would have to see them as beautiful. And we know that's not the case. So therefore, what this view is saying, using an English expression, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But that's not saying the other extreme. Oh, we're just fabricating it. That's not what we're saying. So again, maybe some of us, and by the sounds of the answer, some of us already intellectually accept beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So maybe some of us have come to that conclusion. But the question is that intellectual understanding helping us in our life? Is it?
No.
Because instinctively, our behavior is driven by our instinctive habit. And our instinctive habit, no matter what our intellectual mind is telling us, our instinctive habit is the beauty is there. And that's why we have instinctively this attachment. So what we want to do is to bring that intellectual understanding of beauty in the eye of the beholder into experience through meditation, through doing the wisdom practice, the Vipassana practice, coming to realize the nature of reality, to come to directly realize that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Then, in our behavior, we can appreciate the beauty without any attachment. So that's the long-term goal. Okay. One more presentation. Yeah.
Why, even if I understand and internalize the concept that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, why would that keep me from being attached? I am the beholder. I see beauty. It doesn't matter if it's inherently there or not. For me, this creates this experience. Like, why would that?
But if you're creating the beauty, why are you having attachment to the object?
Because the object...
The beauty is not in the object.
It's not in the object, but it's the trigger of the experience.
Ah, it's the trigger.
I need the trigger for that.
And that's the problem, is we crave and attach the trigger instead of the source.
But
that's the thing.
You can't experience the beauty, or maybe you don't.
But if we really appreciated, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder experientially, actually, there is no way we could develop any craving or attachment. It would be illogical. It would just make no sense whatsoever.
Why?
Because there's no beauty there to crave.
But it triggers an experience of beauty within me. I still need the trigger. I'm not saying there's inherent beauty. I accept and understand that another person could look at that and say,
And, yes, it is a trigger. And understanding that, we would understand that if we develop craving and attachment, we would lose our experience of pleasure. So would we want to do that? Because attachment interferes with our enjoyment of pleasure. Because if we really experientially realize beauty in the eye of the beholder, we would experientially realize that craving and attachment is destroying our pleasurable experiences. So we would never actually enter into it. Why would you, you know?
I'd like to add to that. We're not craving for it. We're just appreciating something.
And if we appreciate something, very good. Then we enjoy it. Then we enjoy. Again, the measure of whether we have craving or attachment mixed into the appreciation is, if we don't get that thing, do we get frustrated and upset? If we don't, then probably there's not so much craving and attachment. If we really get upset and frustrated when we don't get the enjoyable thing, attachment, a lot of attachment there. Yeah, quick question, then we have to really move on.
Just want to see if I understood. So saying the flowers are beautiful is ignorant because
they're not
of their own?
Saying the flowers are beautiful from their own sign is ignorance. Okay. Saying the flowers are beautiful is not ignorance.
But if I say I like the flowers...
That's okay.
That's okay if I don't have any attachment or it's DMS.
Perfect. Okay. It's okay. I want to come back to this. So what we can see is the long-term strategy to overcome this is get rid of ignorance. That's the long-term strategy. So we're going to look at how to do that through the Vipassana and the wisdom practice in a few days. But also, we want a short-term strategy while we're working on that, because that could take some time. We want a short-term strategy of how to minimize the impact of this process. And we're going to look at that tomorrow morning. What can we do right now at these various points to stop the process or reduce the impact of the process? That's the topic for tomorrow morning. So I'm going to leave that on the board and we're going to look at that tomorrow morning. And then the last presentation, and this ties into a question I think someone had, is what sorts of factors affect the growth of mental affliction. So what things contribute to mental afflictions arising? Because if we can identify the various factors that lead to mental afflictions, then we can start to work with those to reduce the mental afflictions. So generally we talk about six factors leading to mental afflictions. The first one is C. Again, habit. So let's say, for example, anger. One factor that is necessary to have anger is to have the habit of getting angry. If we don't have it, then it's impossible to get angry. We all have the seed of anger. Some of us, the seed is much stronger, and little things can cause us anger. Others, the seed or the habit is very weak. It takes a lot for us to get angry. But we all have the seed of anger and other mental afflictions. So without that, we couldn't get angry. Then we need, the second point is, of course, we need an object for a mental affliction to arise. That object, of course, can be external or internal. So an object could be a memory. A particular memory provokes a mental affliction. But that's the object. We need an object for a mental affliction to arise. Sometimes, of course, it's not obvious to us what that object is that caused a mental affliction to arise, but it was there. Then we need another thing. We need what's called inappropriate attention, which means to be observing that object in an incorrect way. For example, here with the flowers, let's say you have the seed of attachment. The object, we see the flowers. The inappropriate attention would be, one example would be, the beauty's there. They're inherently attractive. These three are necessary. They are the necessary causes for a mental affliction to arise. So we need each one of those. We need the seed, the habit, we need an object, and we need to be focusing on that object in a inappropriate, in a wrong way. So these are necessary causes. Then we can talk about three factors that also contribute. And the first of those is familiarity, which of course is very closely related to seed habit. But I think it's listed here separately to highlight to us that if we allow a mental affliction to just, we just leave, let it go, you know, then we're going to become more and more familiar with that mental affliction, meaning it's going to be easier and easier and easier to arise in future. For example, maybe we only have a small habit of getting angry now, but if we allow that anger to keep expressing itself, then we'll become more and more familiar with anger, meaning in future it's going to become much more easy for us to get angry. So I think this is to highlight this fact, that we shouldn't just allow the mental afflictions to run their course, because it means it's going to be easier for that mental affliction to come up in the future. Yeah, so if neuroplasticity would be wiring up at the neurological level, would be rewiring the neurons more and more for that pathway of anger. That would be the equivalent explanation with neuroscience.
So the habit is more like familiar.
Yeah, they're the same, but
I think it's,
yeah, this is the habit.
For the problem for familiar,
yeah.
Because it's big, it's small. If you anger,
yeah,
small,
yeah,
then come a habit to anger about more.
Again, I think this is listed separately than this, because just to highlight to us that if we just allow the mental afflictions to run out, it's just going to get stronger in the future. So maybe not a good idea to let the mental afflictions just go their own course. Then there are two other factors that affect. First one is society, or we could say cultural conditioning. In the original text, the word here was like associating with, I think, like bad companions, meaning associating with people who affect you in a negative way. And it's very, very interesting here, this fifth point, is, you know, often in our modern society, often people say, I'm an independent thinker, I have my own views. That's impossible. There's so much cultural conditioning going on that it's impossible to have an independent view. And that's so obvious when you see someone within a certain culture and you see how much they've been affected by the culture, and yet they say, I'm an independent thinker, I'm not affected by the things around me. And yet their views are so much informed by the culture that they're in. We don't even realise how much we're affected by this cultural conditioning. So I think it's important to realise this, how much we can be affected by the people around us. And the other point is media. So not only people, but media. And in the original texts here on this topic, this was listed as something like wrong explanations, meaning if we're reading some wrong explanations about things, that can lead to, of course, mental afflictions. And so, of course, here the media also has so much impact on us. Incredible. And unfortunately, it seems like in many countries now, the modern media is very much biased for one reason or another. And so we're not really receiving the accurate information, and we're just receiving whoever wants to send us. So we're so much affected by the media. So these are three conditions that also contribute to mental afflictions arising. So it can be very helpful to understand these six factors so that we can at least work with these and try to reduce their impact in terms of leading to mental afflictions. Any questions about any of these 6 points, and then we'll finish.
Maybe I was mistaken to think. I thought, where does the seed come from? I thought the seed comes from the society, the education,
the seed.
Because we are born with a clear mind.
No.
So, okay, but
we're not.
No, but okay, but before we were born, let's say before our life, also, so we got it from society, from external. Where does the seed come from? That's what I'm trying to understand.
It's always been there. What I think you're trying to say is that these things here have a strong impact in this life, right, to strengthen that seed.
Okay.
That's what we're saying.
But it was always there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think what we're indicating is that this sort of cultural conditioning and through media has such a strong impact on affecting these habits. Without, and often we're not aware of it.
Yeah.
And we think we're not affected, but we are. Better just to recognize that and try to work with that. Okay.
Regarding the fifth factor, society, you're not only talking about Western society.
No, all society.
Even in groups, which is very human in general. Right?
Sure. I mean, in the original text, this was talking about associating with bad companions, was literally the term used here. Meaning, if we associate with people who affect us in a negative way, then of course we can have much more mental affliction. So that's, yes, across the board.
Negative is not just like killing or stealing.
No, no, no.
Negative is just thinking this should mean this.
Well, you know, a friend who's encouraging us to have more craving and attachment for things. I mean, that's not helpful, is it? You know, a person who's encouraging us to you know, we need to work an extra 20 hours a week to earn more money so we can have a bigger car and sort of, you know, neglect the family. This is not helpful.
Yeah, but it's not just, let's think about, like, human groups, like, older, perceiving women as should be this or that because they're not as strong.
Yeah, and the idea of slavery and all of that sort of thing. Exactly,
so
all this.
Necessarily what we perceive now as a Western person.
No, 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 this is across the board.
It's anything that goes like in
cross-cultural. Cross-cultural. Oof. We've only got time for one question, so maybe someone who hasn't asked the question yet, anyone? Yeah.
To his question, I don't understand. How can the seed be there when the nature, the true nature of the mind is clarity? It's a contradiction. I don't understand it.
Yeah, and that's something also we're going to be looking at in the Nature of Reality Day. Because if the seed was part of the nature of the mind, we'd be stuck. We couldn't do anything because that's the nature of the mind. And there are modern theories, modern philosophies, which say exactly this. They say the human basic human nature is greed, is jealousy, is anger. That's it. You're stuck with it. Maybe you can reduce it a little bit, but that's it. No hope. What the Buddha discovered, and of course many contemplatives over the centuries have discovered through their personal experience, is that's not the case. In fact, they've actually managed to eliminate these things from their mind 100%. So, of course, the way to understand this is through personal experience. I mean, that's the of course, the proof is in the expression, the proof is in the pudding, you know, is all the things I'm presenting here are different theories and so forth. And as I said at the beginning, don't accept them just because I'm telling you about it. Don't accept them even if I say the Buddha said that. I mean, it doesn't help. We need to check and test them and see whether they make sense to us. So that's, you know, what we need to do, really. We need to be like a good scientist running the experiment. If we don't run the experiment, it's just another theory. And that's unfortunate, is that there are a lot of modern-day theories about many things, including nature of reality, but often the people who put them together don't provide any method for testing the theory. Either you accept it or you reject it. There's no way to test it. The Buddha said, here's my theory, and here's how you test it. But it's up to us to test it. If we don't test it, it's just another theory which may or may not make sense. It may or may not benefit us. So we need to test it if we want to really see, is it going to benefit us? Only then will we know. Okay, let's stop there. We've run out of time. So again, discussion topics. And actually, Renato has kindly offered to write the questions on the board during lunchtime. So if you don't want to write them down now, they'll be on the board when you come back from lunch. But just to mention the questions anyway. So this morning we talked a lot, or something, about attachment and anger. So the first question is, discuss practical methods for dealing with anger and attachment in your daily life. So discuss practical methods for dealing with anger and attachment in your daily life. And I think here that if you have already an effective method that you use to deal with attachment or anger, it would be maybe good to offer that to the group, maybe helpful to other people in the group. The second question is about these six factors here. The second question is about these six factors. The question is, discuss practical advice for dealing with the six factors. Discuss practical advice for dealing with the six factors. Meaning, what's some practical advice to reduce the impact of these six factors? The third question goes back to yesterday afternoon's topic about the mind. So the third question is, does the Buddhist concept of mind seem plausible? Meaning, does it make sense? Does the Buddhist concept of mind seem plausible? Does it make sense? The Buddhist concept of mind. And the second part of the third question is, what sort of evidence would support or negate this concept? So, what sort of evidence would support or negate this concept? Meaning, can you think of any empirical evidence, scientific evidence, that would either support the Buddhist theory of mind or would seem to contradict it? Like, one example that comes to mind is, you know, they've done studies of people who've had past life memories. That seems to support the Buddhist theory of mind. But there may be other empirical studies that seem to oppose. So if you know of any evidence that would either support the Buddhist theory of mind or oppose it.
What do you mean the Buddhist theory of mind? Because you talked about the general stuff when you said how the Buddhist is in the mind.
Well, in terms of the mind not being physical, in terms of mind, the conservation of consciousness, that the mind didn't begin at the beginning of this life and end at the end of this life. Those ideas.